Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jeffrey Canada is throwing a tight net over Harlem, determined to boost every kid's chance there of having a shot at the American dream, or at least at middle class. His prime targets, the kids least likely to succeed, with low test scores and broken families. Tonight on Point, Canada's crusade to help Harlem's children. We begin in Iraq, where U.S. airstrikes killed up to 25 people today in Fallujah in an attempt to destroy a suspected safe house for members of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's terror network. That network was responsible for most of the attacks yesterday in Iraq that left over 100 dead, and it's been responsible for a series of attacks in recent weeks. I spoke earlier to Vivian Walt, Baghdad correspondent for Time magazine. I asked her to describe the airstrikes today in Fallujah.
Well, the U.S. launched four missiles on Fallujah today. This is the third time in the last week that they've done this, that they've launched major airstrikes over Fallujah. I mean, Fallujah is essentially a no-go area for them at this point. This has become an aerial battle. And they claim that they nearly got Zarqawi, the most wanted man in Iraq. They think that they came very, very close to killing him. And by all accounts, this seems to be from intelligence that was gathered by a predator, one of these surveillance devices way up in the sky that can see things very clearly. And it seems like they've very narrowly missed killing the guy that they've been wanting for 15 months now.
Why are U.S. forces so convinced that al-Zarqawi is in Fallujah?
You know, clearly, a lot of times the U.S. will appear to be confident, whereas in fact there's not much basis to it, but this time, for the last couple of weeks, they do seem to have gotten their hands on some fairly good intelligence. And if you recall, a few weeks ago, they picked up one of Zarqawi's top lieutenants. And from what we can make out reading tea leaves here in Baghdad, the man in custody appears to be somewhat cooperating and leading them a little closer to their target. And all efforts have now been focused on Fallujah.
Do you get a sense that U.S. forces have perhaps imposed a deadline on themselves of June the 30th next week, the handover to track down and capture al-Zarqawi?
Well, Julian, I think they would love that. I mean, of course, time is running out. We've got 4 or 5 days left here. It's been increasingly violent. I mean, it's not simply a symbolic deadline. They would love to have al-Zarqawi in their hands before this ceremony to transfer sovereignty. It would be a wonderful victory. But on top of that, they really are extremely concerned about what havoc he can wreak in the next few days. And there's been constant bombings. Tonight we've heard several mortars go off from where I'm sitting. There have been two bomb attacks tonight. One has killed a representative of the Grand Ayatollah Sistani in Baghdad, and one was targeted at the head of the Baghdad City Council. So it's just everywhere, really. These guys have an immense amount of weaponry in their hands, and they seem to be using it at an accelerating pace.
There continues to be talk about the possibility of introducing martial law in Iraq. Is there a debate?
Yes, there is. And we were briefed tonight by the Minister of Interior, which deals with the police, and the Minister of Defense. These are the two key ministries in the new government. These are new ministers. Both of them seemed very keen to impose some kind of martial law, although they said it would probably not be national. I mean, there are parts of this country that are fairly calm. What they would do is leave it to each governorate, each province, if you like, to make a determination. And that's really starting to be felt. I mean, a dusk to dawn curfew is already in effect as of yesterday in the northern city of Mosul. And you could see that being replicated around the country in various parts if this continues.
And, of course, Mosul, where you say there's been the introduction of a dusk-to-dawn curfew, very badly hit in the latest bomb attacks.
Very badly hit. There were 7 car bombs yesterday in Mosul outside 7 police stations. There appear to have been at least about 60 people killed in those attacks in Mosul and more than 200 wounded. We don't know yet how many of those today died of their wounds, but we can only imagine that that death toll will start climbing if it hasn't done so already. This is a country that has buried a lot of people today, and I think the U.S. forces certainly are very worried about the next days ahead.
There must be growing apprehension then about what will happen on June the 30th and indeed immediately afterwards.
Well, yes, I mean, there is, June. And, you know, if you think of the immense historical significance of this date, June 30th, it's going to be the first real independence without the Ba'ath Party in 35 years. And yet there's really none of the pomp and ceremony that you would expect to associate with a day like this. Everything is being done very, very hush-hush. All the transition ceremonies are very closed. They're behind big fortified walls. The press coverage even is just a very select group of reporters and TV cameras who then cover it for the rest of the press corps. So you're really seeing a very, very muted handover here. Nothing like the kind of handover which President Bush probably expected a year ago.
Vivian Walt, many thanks.
Thank you.
And Vivian Walt is Baghdad correspondent of Time magazine. I spoke to her earlier in Baghdad. Jeffrey Canada grew up in the South Bronx. His father abandoned the family when he was 4 years old. His mother raised him and his 3 brothers, supporting the family on low-paid jobs and welfare. Now the organization that Canada runs, Harlem Children's Zone, is going door-to-door trying to find families like his own and catch children before they fall through the cracks. In a cover story last Sunday, the New York Times magazine called Canada's work one of the biggest social experiments of our time. At the heart of the task, a giant safety net, a tight web of services in Harlem to help those kids least likely to succeed. Tonight on Point, Jeffrey Canada's grand plan for Harlem's children. Do you believe one man's vision can transform a troubled neighborhood, or does it take more? Are some places beyond being helped? Is Canada's dream of reaching every child in Harlem pie in the sky? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Valley Stream, New York, is Jeffrey Canada. He's chief executive of Harlem Children's Zone, Inc., which helps children in a 60-block area in Harlem by providing a web of educational, social, and medical services. He was the subject of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story, The Harlem Project. He's author of Reaching Up for Manhood, Transforming the Lives of Boys in America, and Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. Good evening and welcome to you, Jeffrey Canada.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm really thrilled to be here with you this evening.
And we're very pleased to have you with us. Now, if I could ask you to sum up the mission of the Harlem Children's Zone in a phrase, what would it be?
We're trying to make sure that we leave no child behind for real. That we want to make sure every single child, no matter what circumstances they come from, no matter how poor they are, no matter how poor their families are, no matter what kind of educational experience they've had up until the time we reached them, we want to make sure every single one of those children succeed.
But you are concerned, are you not, to reach out to the most disadvantaged?
We really believe that one of the issues that we face is that people who have done this work have also often done it with people who sign up. Parents who will say, yes, I'll be part of your program. But the most hardest to reach folks, the children who are in the most desperate need because their parents aren't going to reach out. In fact, their parents may even not want their child to participate. That these are the children which I think are the most vulnerable, and we see those as our number one priority in the Harlem Children's Zone.
So these are really rock-bottom kids, are they, or at the moment anyway?
I think that we would say that these are the most the children who are most at risk of failing and of having the kinds of negative outcomes that so many of America's children have.
And do you recognize in some of them the child that you once were growing up in the South Bronx?
Well, I not only recognize the child that I was, but I see all of my friends. I see this whole group of children that were smart and talented and creative and funny. And over the years, I watched these young people. I watched their lives disintegrate. I watched them turn to drugs and crime and despair. And I always knew that if there was someone who could have come in to help us, who could have been there to lend a helping hand, that many of these kids would have been successful and would have made it. And every time I look at the children I work with, I see those same kids that I grew up with, that I knew by every reason in terms of their intelligence and IQ they should have made it, but they had not a real chance because of the social circumstances they found themselves in.
What made the difference for you? I mean, how did you end up at Bowdoin and then Harvard's Graduate School of Education?
Well, you know, it really had to do with a web of supports that started with my mother and my grandmother and aunts and uncles and really a couple of teachers and one or two guys on the street who, for no reason that I ever understood, picked me up and picked me out of the crowd and said, "Jeff, no matter what else anyone else does, we're not going to let you do this." And they wouldn't let me smoke, and they wouldn't let me drink alcohol or smoke marijuana. And, I mean, these guys tried to keep me straight. And I think if it had not been for that whole complete web, my life could have turned out totally different. Sometimes I look at my life and say, you know, except for a couple of accidents of fate, I could have ended up like so many of my friends.
Yeah, you talk about accidents of fate there. What you're really trying to do now is to ensure that those kinds of interventions that lift a child up are more systematic.
I think that we have to build a series of supports. You see, the one thing I really honestly believe is that we actually know how to save these children. And so when you go into communities like Harlem and you find that 70, 80% of the children are failing, and not only are failing now, but they've been failing for decades. And people sometimes think I'm exaggerating. I'm talking 30, 40 years. The same schools have been failures. The same communities have contributed to the worst social problems in that area. When we find those places that we actually know what to do, we just haven't done it systematically and we haven't done it at scale in a way that will impact enough children so you can actually change the fabric of that community.
And you aim to be with those kids from cradle to college.
We really, you know, we used to believe that we could simply get kids through high school. And when I first began this work, that really was our challenge, you know, get them to graduate high school. But nowadays, in our current labor market, you need more than a high school education. You need some post-secondary education. And so we have said our goal now is to get our kids not only into college, but through college, because once getting them in, it's just so hard for these poor kids to make it through. And if for kids who don't go into college, to get them into a good trade school so they can actually learn a skill so they can support themselves and their families.
So how many kids are you now helping, and with what kind of programs?
We have in our program right now, in this one defined geographic area, we're currently working with 4,000 children. We plan to be working with about 6,500 children 2 years from now. And then 5 years from now, we plan to be working with about 10,000 children in this defined geographic area of Central Harlem.
And you're basically now running, as far as I can see, a small corporation.
Well, there's a bunch of folk who are engaged. You know, there's no way you're going to save those kids unless you have a talented, trained staff of committed individuals who are prepared to work with these kids. Our programs run year-round. You'll find every day in my programs in Harlem, our kids are working till 6 o'clock at night during the academic year. We'll run all summer long that we really believe you've got to connect these poorest kids to some of the most talented people in the country if we're going to have a chance of really succeeding with them. And we've got about right now about 650 people who are working at the organization. A lot of those are part-timers who work with us during the after-school hours. But there's quite a few folk who are engaged in this mission right now.
Jeffrey Canada, do stay with us. We're talking tonight about Jeffrey Canada's bold plan to help Harlem's children. What are you hearing, Canada's optimism, or is Canada only chipping away at a problem that's too large for him to solve? Is Canada's prescription for Harlem exactly what your town, your city needs? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing Jeffrey Canada's crusade to help Harlem's children. What do you make of Canada's grand plan? Can his vision and energy transform a neighborhood? Or is he tackling problems too big, too entrenched to solve with a web of programs? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Valley Stream, New York, Jeffrey Canada. He's chief executive of Harlem Children's Zone, Inc., which helps children in a 60-block area in Harlem by providing a web of educational, social, and medical services. He was the subject of last Sunday's New York Times magazine cover story, The Harlem Project. He's author of Reaching Up for Manhood, Transforming the Lives of Boys in America, and Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. Jeffrey Canada, just tell me a little bit more in detail about this web of educational, social, and medical services you provide for the children.
Sure. We're really trying to do three big things in our Harlem zone. The first is we're trying to rebuild a sense of community, and we do that by forming block associations, forming tenant associations, connecting a leadership group with one another, and helping people figure out how to solve their own problems. You know, sometimes these problems look impossible until you meet someone two blocks away who says, yeah, I had exactly the same thing. They were selling drugs on a corner. I had these empty lots over here. And let me tell you what I did. And people learn so quickly that these things are possible when they hear it from other people who have done the work themselves. We fix the parks and the playgrounds to make sure that they're places that parents feel like they can bring their kids. We've really focused on planting trees and other kinds of things just to make the neighborhood look like the kind of place that children shouldn't be afraid of, but actually cares for children. So that's the first thing. The second thing we're doing is we're actually creating a best practice program at each developmental stage of a child's life. So we start with a program called Baby College for parents of children between 0 and 3. And we're just trying to help those parents understand all we know right now about brain development in early children. We have a lot of research out there. We know what to do. What happens is that when we looked in Harlem, we said, geez, there's, you know, thousands of things written on this area of children's 0 to 3 and how to develop their brains. What's actually being offered in Harlem? There was not one program, not one, for parents that offered any of that knowledge that people take for granted in other communities. So we offered Baby College. We partner with Barry Brazelton, who's a pretty famous pediatrician, probably one of the best in the country. He's helped train our staff, and he consults with us on a regular basis on this, him and his Touch Points team. We go right from that program to our four-year-old program, where we keep our kids in the best staff program. There's a 5-to-1 staffing ratio in the program. The kids are there from 8 o'clock in the morning until 5:45 in the afternoon, and guess what? We test those kids when they first come in, and we find that a lot of our kids are delayed and very delayed according to the Bracken scale that we use. When we test those kids in August after they've been with us for a year, these kids have caught up to their peers, and we think that this is the basic model you have to use. You have to give our kids more time on task, intervene early, but we have programs that run right from elementary right off to the high school, and then we have a group of kids right now who are in college that we're supporting getting through college. So that's the second big thing, having these best practice programs. And the third thing is that we really are trying to take this to scale. We are trying to work with all of the children in this area because we're trying to reach a point where so many of our kids have been exposed to this sort of new way of thinking about themselves and their lives and their careers, that we actually reach a tipping point. So at any given day in our area, there are about 2,000 children who are in our programs that we really try and push the envelope to make sure we get as many children as possible connected early on and staying with us throughout the their life in the zone.
Let's take a call from Anne in Hastings on Hudson, New York. And Anne, what did you want to say? I'm sorry, we seem to have a bit difficulty there hearing from Anne in Hastings on Hudson. Let's go to William, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. William?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening to you.
Good evening.
Yeah, Jeffrey.
Yes.
William Gordner, I'm calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Actually, I live in Detroit, Michigan, and I'm here for 2 weeks attending the Harvard Summer Leadership Institute in the School of Divinity. And we're all, there's 50 of us here, and we're all folk who are working in the church on community and economic activities with a faith-based slant to them. And your name came up through one of our discussions earlier this week, and I was just listening to the radio, and it was just so divine that I would hear and just interview and I'd be able to talk with you.
William, do you think that one man's vision, such as that of Jeffrey Canada, can transform a troubled neighborhood?
Oh, it's no question about it. All it takes is one man with a vision. We were talking about leadership today. And one man with a vision, with a dream, can make a difference. And just like Martin Luther King with his dream and with his vision, as long as he continues to show love and compassion for those young people, he can certainly transform the lives of these young people. Because I see it in my business. I have an educational consulting company. We represent 29 black colleges throughout the country. And we produce a single application that will allow high school seniors to apply to all those schools for only $30.
Mm.
And I would love to work with you in New York and at least to discuss our program with you. And you may have some young people who may want to at least use this application as the first start in the college application process.
William, thanks for that. Jeffrey Canada, I mean, it does require a lot more, though, than vision. Where's your cash coming from?
Yeah, you know, this project right now, this year, our organization will be about a $24 million operation. 2 years from now, when we expect to be serving close to 7,000 kids, we'll probably be upwards of $30 million. And we plan to, when we're serving 10,000 kids at a time, to be really up to about $39 million. So we have a very ambitious fundraising strategy. We've been going to the private market for a lot of the support, foundations, corporations, and individuals. And I think that's the answer for us, but it's not the answer for the problem. To me, the answer for the problem is that we've got to get our government to invest real dollars in saving poor children. Part of what we're trying to do is cost it out. We think right now for about an extra $1,400 a child that you can take children who will end up in jails and in prisons and in foster care and in homeless shelters, costing us $20,000-$30,000 a year, and that we can make sure that those children succeed and they get jobs and they become productive Americans. And we think the government ought to and has to get involved in investing in these areas, but they're not going to do it until we prove it can work. And they won't even do it after we prove it can work without some real advocacy, I think, by people saying that these kids are worth it. These are American kids. We don't care if they're brown. We don't care if they're black. We don't care if they're white. These are our kids, and we've got to spend what it takes to save them. And so we're raising a lot of dollars. We're doing it all the time. And so I spend a lot of my time doing that. And quite honestly, I wish I didn't have to spend as much time doing it. But I think it's important to prove that this can happen at a scale that we're talking about right now.
We're talking to Jeffrey Canada about his crusade to help Harlem's children. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's hear now from Ted. He's calling from Brooklyn in Massachusetts.
Jeffrey Canada?
Yes.
My name is Ted Howe. I'm a 1955 graduate from Bowdoin College, and I met you once. I did at Bowdoin when sort of a teacher's conference.
Could very easily have happened. As you know, I'm connected with Bowdoin, and I'm on the board there.
Okay. Yeah. Ted, what did you want to ask Mr. Canada?
I'm retired now, but I was a clinical social worker for 40 years plus, and I still volunteer in the prisons with guys, and My thought is that, you know, I've seen a lot of people come from, I focus on really working with the bottom 15 that percent that Jeffrey talks about in his writing. And I don't even think you can give up on them. I've found groups that I've worked with and talked with in the prisons to be as articulate sometimes and even more on point than some of the graduate students I've had at in social work school. So,
okay, Ted, can I just summarize where I think you're trying to go with Jeffrey Canada, namely what you do, Mr. Canada, to try to address the social dysfunctions in the families that you're dealing with?
Yes, and, you know, part of the issues that we're facing right now is the fact that we have huge numbers of our children who are growing up unprepared to face what we would consider to be the normal hurdles that young people face in America, and we provide a range of clinical supports to kids. But let me just say the one thing that I think that the last caller, Ted, was getting at. We have about 12% of all African-American men today in jail. It is one of the largest social experiments that's ever been carried out. It is a huge, huge waste of potential and talent. It's widely expensive, and we have to, as a nation, address this issue. Right here in New York, they found that 50% of all African-American men in New York City are unemployed. I mean, we're not talking South Africa. We're not talking Haiti. We're talking right here in New York. This is really criminal. It is so easy to see how this conveyor belt starts very early on that ends up with our kids being in prisons and jails. And, yes, they are often smart, and we've got to do something to interrupt that conveyor belt.
So what do you do then to stop that conveyor belt running in the first place?
The most important thing is to provide these kids with a real education. And I cannot tell you, public education is the battleground that we have to fight the next civil rights struggle in this nation right now. There is no way these kids are going to make it unless they get a good education. And the schools that so many of these kids go to right now are just deplorable. The statistics of failure in these places that have been documented for decades, and they're still allowed to go on and produce the tawdry results that they produce, is really shocking. And I think that we've got to do something fundamentally different with public education in America today.
But do you try in the course of your programs to deal, for instance, with bad parenting? And I here recall Bill Cosby's statements at the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. He said the lower economic people are not holding up their end in this deal. These people are not parenting. They're buying things for their kids. $500 sneakers for what? And won't spend $200 for Hooked on Phonics.
Right. And you know, there are parts of what Bill said that I absolutely agree with. But there's some parts that I think were taken out of context, slightly naive. And let me tell you the parts that I agree with. We have a lot of parents right now that honestly don't know what they should be doing as parents to help raise healthy children. Part of what we do at Baby College is sit and talk with parents and say, this is why you have to do this. This is why you have to read to your kid every day. This is why you can't allow your kid to watch TV. This is why you have to sing with your kid. And we mean every single day you have to do this, not some days, not Saturdays, Sundays off. So we take this problem on head on. We tell our parents that this is how you're going to have to do. Even if you can't read, you can still design a household so a child can study, cutting off the TV, cutting off the radio, not allowing any telephone calls, creating a little study area, no matter if it's just a box in a corner that a kid has a place for books. We can do that, and we can help parents. But we have right now the largest marketing effort ever to teens and children in this country, that there is a constant cacophony of sounds and visions that teach our kids about sex and alcohol and consumption, and it's never ending. And it's not hard to find, to see where parents, after a while, you know, you've got this poor parent on welfare. and she's trying to do the right thing. And you've got Michael Jordan and every other famous, wildly powerful person trying to convince this kid that they have to have these sneakers if they're going to be a man and they're going to be survived. And I think it's...
Let's just bring in Walter in Totowa, New Jersey, Jeffrey Canada, because I think he is going down that same route as well. Walter?
Mr. Canada, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you for the leadership you're showing for the people of Harlem. I'm a middle-aged white guy, and I've come to the same conclusion that you have, that education is the only answer, and that leading kids to respect education is the way to get out of the trouble that those kids are in. I'd like to just point out that the kids in the Harlem area and the other minority areas are being misled by the same athletes that you just mentioned, the Michael Jordans of the world, into believing that this is the way out of their problems. This is the way out of poverty. Several years ago, there was an article in Sports Illustrated by a black educator, actually from Harvard, who talked about the number of black accountants, the number of black lawyers, the number of black doctors, and the fact that these numbers were never shown to kids as being a much more realistic goal than being able to shoot the 30-foot hook shot. And I think you're to be congratulated, and I hope that you can emphasize education as much as you can and dispel some of this voodoo attraction to become the big-time star of athletics when a much more realistic goal could be to be an educated man contributing to a society.
Jeffrey Canada, are you trying to create or to educate, anyway, the role models of tomorrow for the African-American community?
I think we absolutely have to. And let me tell you an area that I've been trying to get my kids involved in. I've been trying to get my kids involved in Wall Street. If you want to see examples of folk who can make money, huge amounts of money, legally, who are willing to take risk and chances. You don't have to grow up to be a drug dealer and take your chances on the street being murdered and killed or locked up for 30 years if you've got the intestinal fortitude to take a few risks and be ambitious. You can go to school and work hard and try and make it on Wall Street. Our kids don't even have a clue of what the average person on Wall Street makes. I mean, it is so much more than the drug dealer that they're looking up to, that we've got to break through some of these barriers and stereotypes and open up the possibilities for kids, because there's some kids just out of sheer greed would say, you know what, I'm going to study because I'm going to try and get it like this person. That's the way you really get there, not getting a gun and sticking somebody up. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I myself, I've been in social services all my life, and I believe in the helping professions. But there is absolutely nothing wrong with us trying to develop a class in Harlem that's going to be in the finance and really take that seriously. And I think that those are the kind of role models that we've got to have for our kids. They don't simply understand the kind of money that other people make by going to school and studying hard. And I think we've got to open up those possibilities.
Jeffrey Canada, do stay with us. We'll continue the conversation. We're talking about what's being called one of the biggest social experiments of our time. Jeffrey Canada and his mission to change the odds for the children of Harlem. Is Canada's prescription for Harlem exactly what your town, your city needs? Does he have a bold new solution to help America's underclass? Or has Canada bitten off too much? Is his dream of reaching every child in Harlem pie in the sky? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Jeffrey Canada's crusade to make sure no child in Harlem slips through the cracks. What do you make of Canada's grand plan? Can his vision and energy transform a neighborhood, or is he tackling problems too big, too entrenched to solve with a web of programs? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Valley Streams, New York, Jeffrey Canada. He's chief executive of Harlem Children's Zone, Inc., which helps children in a 60-block area in Harlem by providing a web of educational, social and medical services. And on the line now, a caller from Harlem, New York, Shanda. And Shanda, are you supportive of what Jeffrey Canada is trying to do?
Definitely. I think what Jeffrey's doing is amazing.
It's amazing, and it needs to be done, in your opinion, from what you see around you?
Yes, on a daily basis, living here in Harlem, I see children who seem to lack the focus and direction that they need to be successful as adults.
And these are people who, in Jeffrey Canada's parlance, have fallen through the cracks.
I think so, and I think that there's a certain amount of helplessness and hopelessness and despair. And so, you know, even if parents want to somehow help their children, I'm not sure if they really know what tools they need to be equipped with to help that come to pass.
Jeffrey Canada, how can somebody like Shanda in Harlem, New York, help you?
Well, I think that one of the things that we're trying to really get out to everyone who lives in communities like Harlem is that we've got to set a new standard of excellence for our children. We're asking folk to join with us in holding the adults who are paid money to educate and support our children, to hold those adults responsible, to hold principals, teachers, the chancellor, the mayor, the folks in not-for-profit like myself, that we've got to end the time when we go and ask people about our children and they start giving us excuses about why they haven't learned. Oh, they come from a broken home. Oh, English isn't their first language. Oh, you know, there's been some issues. Oh, the past teacher didn't do a good job. We're paid to provide services and deliver services for these children. And if we, in good conscience, are going to take those paychecks, then we have to be able to deliver, or else we should be in a different business. And I think folks like Shanda have to hold us accountable for the highest set of expectations and outcomes for our children. Because right now, and this is the scary thing, Julian, right now, in the state of New York, only 12% of African-American students by the eighth grade can do math on state standards levels. That is so unbelievable. That is so unacceptable that failure is now normal. You understand what I'm saying? People think it's normal for children to fail because everybody around you is failing. So we've got to change that set of expectations starting with the adults.
Okay, let's hear from Fawn, calling from Madison in Wisconsin. Fawn, what would you like to ask Jeffrey Canada?
Well, I think that you're asking the rhetorical question is, you know, is the work that Mr. Canada is doing the right thing, or is it biting off more than he can chew? I think something's got to be done, and Mr. Kennedy, you're doing more than anyone else is apparently at this moment, that we really need to take a strong stand in this country to address the class. I mean, oftentimes race is used as a proxy for class, but I think they're intertwined, and you are addressing them both. So I'd like to really give kudos to you for what you're doing. I'd also like to point out that I just got word that Harvard University is apparently offering full scholarships to any honors student from a lower income bracket, I guess whose family makes less than $40,000 a year. They have a free ride to Harvard for 4 years, and I think that's definitely a big step in the right direction. Granted, it only addresses honors students, but it's a big step in the right direction for these kids to have something to look forward to.
Jeffrey Canada, you spoke earlier about the need for more federal funding. Can you really make a difference just in one corner of Harlem, or must you roll out over the rest of New York and indeed other big cities in the United States?
Well, one of the things that we are really talking about and planning on doing is this September we're going to open up our Practitioners Institute to really help other people who are interested in either the whole concept of the Harlem Children's Zone or any aspect of that to really learn how to provide what we consider to be these best practice programs for young people. We really think that the reason we have to get to 10,000 children is that there are some places where, you know, you can talk about Chicago, Detroit, L.A., Kansas City, where you've got 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 kids who are in real big trouble, and we want to be able to say, well, you need to do 4 Harlem Children's Zones. But there are other places all over this country where the numbers are much more modest. You've got a community or a zip code of 2,000 kids, of 4,000 kids. There we think that people should absolutely learn how to tackle these issues, because we're already working with those kinds of numbers right now and finding success. So we think that we're going to be prepared to help other people who are interested in learning how to do this work, learn how to do it really well.
But in your own mind, by your own admission, there is a judgment day to come for you 8, 10, 12 years down the road to see whether or not your programs in this part of Harlem have proved to be a success.
Yes, and you know, I have told everyone that I expect to be held fully accountable for these outcomes for kids, because anyone who works for my organization who can't deliver, meaning if you've got a third grade class and you're supposed to get that class from where they're reading right now to a year and a half ahead of where it is by the end of the year, and you don't deliver that service, you're going to get a chance to be retrained, and if that doesn't work, we're going to be asked out, and we're going to bring somebody in who can deliver that service. So we're all saying, hold us accountable. There are going to be some key times. We're starting a charter school, and we're starting with a kindergarten and a sixth grade. When our sixth graders have to take, they have to take a statewide eighth grade exam. We know these kids are going to start behind, and we've got to catch them up in a very short period of time. And that'll be the first time that we're going to be held as accountable as everybody else to put up or shut up. We don't think that's the end, by the way. We think we're going to do fine, but we don't think that's victory. Victory will not happen until that same group of kids has gone into college and out of college and are now working adults. Then we'll say, there's the real evidence that this works. Until then, we'll see some indications.
Jeffrey Canada, very many thanks for being with us tonight on Point.
Julian, thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Jeffrey Canada, chief executive of Harlem Children's Zone, Inc., which helps children in a 60-block area in Harlem by providing a web of educational, social, and medical services. Continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Coming up, Jack Beattie joins me for a recap of the week's news. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
각축 수석 대표 여러분.
Despite the united prayers of the general public and the government alike for the safe return of our citizen, a terribly unfortunate event has occurred, one which we cannot prevent ourselves from feelings of deep shock and sorrow.
I have never ordered torture. I will never order torture. The values of this country are such that torture is not a part of our soul.
It began at dawn, insurgents launching attacks primarily on police stations across the Sunni Triangle. In Mosul, at least 44 people were killed in a series of car bombings, including one U.S. soldier. In Ramadi, gunmen attacked two stations and a government building. The fiercest fighting, though, was felt in Bakuba.
In this audio tape, he's threatening to assassinate Iraqi interim Prime Minister Alawi and said that the fight against infidels will continue.
Whenever a chief executive, whenever a president, spends prodigious amounts of energy in an effort to convince the American people of a falsehood, he damages the fabric of democracy.
After a miserable, sleepless night, I woke up Hillary and told her the truth about what had happened between me and Monica Lewinsky. She looked at me as if I had punched her in the gut, almost as angry at me for lying to her in January as for what I had done.
Vice President Cheney wanted this case gone, and the end result of the Supreme Court's decision is that the door is still open.
Effective at noon on July 1st, I will officially step down as governor and pass this honor on to Lieutenant Governor Jody Rell.
I thought it was the best thing I've ever seen since Gone with the Wind. It was fantastic.
He's in no way objective, you know. It's a very subjective film.
It showed me most what an idiot Bush is.
It just shows his lack of initiative, lack of confidence in leadership.
South Korean translator Kim Sun-il is beheaded by his Islamic terrorist captors in Iraq. President Bush says newly declassified memos prove that the administration does not condone torture. Critics say the documents released were glaringly incomplete. A series of attacks in several Iraqi cities kill over 100 just days before next week's transfer of sovereignty. In an audio tape, the man thought to be one of the masterminds behind the Iraq insurgency, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, threatens to kill new Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi. Former Vice President Al Gore accuses President Bush of lying about pre-war links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Bill Clinton's new memoir, My Life, hits bookstores. The Supreme Court says Vice President Cheney does not have to release documents related to his energy task force, at least for now. Connecticut Governor John Rowland resigns amid scandal. And Michael Moore's highly controversial new documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11, debuts to mixed reviews. Jack, a tumultuous week. What stands out for you?
Well, two presidents, really, and Clinton and Bush. And I think we just heard Clinton talking about the Monica Lewinsky affair, and that was his Monica moment, you know, the moment when we looked into his life and saw the weakness of his character. And he was very candid about that last night on Larry King. I don't know if you saw that, but he said, you know, when you get right down to it, we can talk about all the depth, motivation, and so on. But if you look back on a lot of the things you've done in life that you regret, you realize you did them in some way because you could do them. And, you know, that sounds like a superficial comment, but when you think about it, there's something profound. There's a kind of moralist's observation there about human conduct. A lot of the things we do that we regret, we did because we could do them. And he had a lot to say about his political failures. He says his biggest failure was to put health care before welfare reform, and thus to cost the Democrats the 1994 election, that if he had gone out with welfare reform, the public would have thought, well, yeah, this party has changed. It's you know, moving to the center and so on. But the failed health care initiative doomed his party, and he said that was a catastrophic political blunder on his part.
You talked about the two presidents, Jack. The other one, this flurry of memos this week about torture.
Yes, those memos have come out, and in particular, the counterterrorism report, they came out with a corrected version of the terrorism report. Turns out 2003 was the worst year in 20 years for terrorism, but that's not what the report said in April. In April, according to the Undersecretary of State, he said, "You will find in these pages clear evidence that we're prevailing in the fight." Well, what happened between April and today? Well, what happened was that some economists discovered that they had fudged the numbers and that they had stopped the count on terrorist incidents in November, early November of 2003, when some of the worst incidents happened after. So in other words, our government wasn't even telling us the truth about the number of terrorist incidents in a year, and it took some economists to find it out. And yeah, there is that picture of Bush. You know, the New York Times has said, and I think rightly, that I just saw Michael Moore's film, that the most devastating part of this for the president is not Michael Moore's often over-the-top commentary and paranoid schemes and so on. No, it's the seven-minute sequence of Bush looking blankly after he's just heard that the second plane has hit the tower. He's in the room with those kids, and he doesn't know what to do. That's the most frightening part of that film. And in a way, it's kind of his Monica moment.
Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, many thanks for that. And Monday, On Point, we'll be taking a closer look at Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 9/11. And, of course, next Wednesday, June the 30th, the handover of power in Iraq. I'm Julian Marshall, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.